In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Thursday, July 18th, 2013 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. It's Industry Chatter today and every Thursday in the 3 o'clock hour. And my guest today is the President and Chief Technology Officer of Lumetta. His name is Michael Markulek. And Michael, I appreciate you being here today. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to do it. Start with the elevator speech on Lumetta and what you do for customers in the federal space.
Yeah, Lumetta is unique. It's a spin-out from Bell Labs based upon some technology originally used to map the Internet. So if you've ever seen those big Kushball-looking kind of maps of the Internet, that's our technology.
Mm-hmm.
Over the last decade, we've taken that technology and developed into a network mapping, network discovery solution that helps CIOs and chief security officers identify their networks. You know, most organizations don't have a firm handle of where everything is on their network. We help them identify where things are on the network. We look for vulnerabilities at the network kind of layer. And we have a patented technology that looks at leak discovery, connections between two networks, whether they be on the commercial side between a, you know, between business units or between the inside of the network and the Internet, or in the federal sector between, you know, networks of different classification levels, making sure that there is no connections between those networks that there shouldn't be.
So when the Trusted Internet Connection Initiative came out, you got a lot of phone calls, I imagine.
We got a lot of phone calls around TIC. The Trusted Internet Connections Initiative, and for your listeners who aren't, you know, totally familiar with it, was an effort to drive down the number of Internet connections that the government had. Interestingly enough, it succeeded in a lot of ways. It forced organizations to look at where they had these Internet connections. And in some ways, you know, it was, you know, government as usual, right?
Right.
Let's change the definition of an Internet connection so therefore I can move my number down.
Uh-huh.
So things like VPN connections were no longer considered Internet connections. But I think overall it was a very positive step towards, you know, just changing the dynamic, right, the threat landscape for the federal agencies.
What do you advise clients to do to maintain their progress in that? I mean, if you've pared down to a manageable number, how do you make sure that you don't have the same problem the agency had before, which is somebody goes, well, I could use one over here, and pretty soon 30 people have just stuck one over here, and you're back to where you started.
Yeah, you know, I think it goes, and you're hearing a lot in both the federal sector and the commercial world today around continuous monitoring, right? It's not no longer acceptable just to build a good defense. You need to maintain that defense, and you need to make sure that you're looking for those connections, especially today as we see folks with, you know, non-standard IT devices walk in, right? We all talk about BYOD, meaning tablets and laptops, but, you know those cell phones, right, those, you know, next-generation phones act as Internet connections. Right? I can walk into my office, tether my laptop to my iPhone, and all of a sudden I've created another connection out to the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it is about vigilance. It is about understanding, you know, where all the devices are. And it's about this, you know, continuous monitoring. You need to continue to push forward.
Could you say then that TIC has kind of been overcome by events? I mean, just in particular the mobile revolution?
I think the TIC initiative served a useful purpose while it was, you know, active. And I think at this point, you know, the agencies throughout the government have a very good handle on where their Internet connections are. I think BYOD, and as you just alluded to, you know, adding one additional connection because, you know, it makes business sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need to look at those things. And when you do, you know, decide that you're going to allow tablets or laptops or, you know, cell phones to connect to the network, you need to have a responsible policy on how to handle it, right? I think what TIC and some of the other initiatives did, like FISMA, was really, you know, kind of, you know, move the bar up for all of the agencies, right? Now they need to continue to stay there. And, you know, with IT the way it is today, you know, we were talking last weekend over dinner, my 13-year-old son can program a router. You used to have college courses to program a router,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's become a lot easier to add things to the network, to change the network. So it puts a lot more pressure on the CIOs and the chief security officers to maintain their inventory.
That almost sounds like a Moore's law that applies to the deployment of technology and not just the capability of technology. And that's not going to slow down anytime soon, is it?
It's not going to slow down. I'd argue that it's going to accelerate. I do a lot of speaking around BYOD plus, right? So it's bring your own device to work. But it's more than just, as I said, laptops and cell phones. It's things like medical equipment, right? Walk into any hospital now, and all the equipment that sits in a room is tied to a network at some level, right? You think about things as simple as wastewater management or police services, 911 dispatch. That's all on the greater IT network now, right? Mm-hmm. Physical security, the cameras that are in this building, the locks on these doors, most likely are tied to control systems that are on some kind of IP network. So really, it's going to continue to expand. The difficulty is going to continue to expand. We talk to our clients about, helping maintain where all those devices are and then build secure zones so that your physical security equipment is not on the same, network or segment of the network that your email and your web traffic's on.
So it's a similar concept, it sounds like to me, to the Internet of Things concept, which is essentially, my refrigerator and someday my pacemaker will probably be connected to the Internet somehow.
Yeah, your Google glasses.
Exactly. And so that zone defense, I guess, to rip off a sports analogy, it seems to be the only logical way to think about this, because you can't protect everything equivalently, and you probably don't want to necessarily.
Yeah, if you think about, and it's interesting, you can go all the way back to Roman times when, defense in depth was kind of pioneered. But it's still the same kind of strategy. You need to determine, what your critical assets are, whether those assets are physical devices, whether they're, whether they're soldiers on a battlefield, what are you trying to protect? And then develop security posture, security procedures for secure zones that meet that level of threat, right? I'd argue that the DOD needs to protect its secure networks much more than the Department of the Interior needs to protect, the gift shop at the Grand Canyon, right? Those are two things that should be protected, but again, they're protected at different levels, and therefore you have different defense in depth strategies, and you deploy different technologies to protect and maintain them.
Now, when you use those two examples, one's black and one's white, and you can decide which one's which, but there's a whole bunch of gray area in between there, and that grayscale, it varies depending, and prioritizing what gets what and what gets what level of protection strikes me as a pretty hard challenge for agencies to try to sort through right now.
I think it is. I think it's, in government and a lot of civilian companies as well, the idea is we're going to protect everything like it's, like it's Fort Knox. I think we can take a lot of lessons from the financial service folks, right? They've done a good job of risk management, over time, not just with their, their financial assets, right? They've got a chief risk officer. That chief risk officer is now kind of on the network side as well, helping the chief security officer understand what do we need to protect, right? What is the critical set of data that we're willing to spend money to protect, and what are we willing to let pass, right? What are we willing to accept, mm-hmm. right? Because you can't protect everything.
Yeah. Do they develop algorithms to do that, or how do you determine the risk protection ratio and put that plot it on a scale, I guess?
Well, I think you can bring some analytics to it. I think it really comes down to how you value your assets, therefore, what are you willing to spend to protect, right? So you think about, financial service, right? They've got credit card data, they've got individual data, they've got, proprietary data. Think of Morgan Stanley that does, consulting, financial consulting, mm-hmm. right? They have proprietary data. They can rank how important that is, right? How important is that to the company weekly newsletter, right? Or how important is that to, phone numbers to potential prospects, right?
Right?
All of that has value to the company, but I tell organizations, focus on what's your core, right? So if you're a manufacturing company, right, make sure that your manufacturing floor is protected, right? If you have a couple, PCs for your sales guys that get infected with viruses, maybe you lose some clients' phone numbers or maybe your sales guy, does not, fully encrypt his laptop. All right, maybe we can accept that risk, but you can't shut down a manufacturing floor, right? You shut down a manufacturing floor, that's hundreds of millions of dollars.
My guest is Michael Markulek. He's the President Chief Technology Officer of Lumetta. We've talked about the similarities and differences in private sector and public sector, and I want to see if there are some lessons learned that we can talk about when we come back on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose, and we'll continue in just a moment.
Today's Human Capital Management Report brought to you by the Graduate School.
Managers at the Internal Revenue Service won't be receiving any bonuses this year, and union employees at the agency could soon find themselves in a similar situation. Acting IRS Commissioner Danny Werfel says he wants to cancel all of the $98 million in bonuses the IRS was scheduled to hand out. However, an employee union says some of the bonuses are legally required under its collective bargaining agreement. Werfel cited budget cuts as his reason for eliminating the performance award.
Doing more with less, smaller budget, fewer people. Training is the solution, and Graduate School USA is ranked the most affordable and overall best choice for federal training. They offer hundreds of top quality courses, including customized programs that can be taught right at your location online or in their classrooms conveniently located near the L'Enfant Metro. Get more out of your training budget. Visit graduateschool.edu. That's graduateschool.edu.
The Information Management Minute, provided by Iron Mountain.
According to the President's executive order on OPA data of May 9th, making information resources easy to find and usable by the public can help fuel entrepreneurship, innovation, and scientific discovery, can enrich lives, and significantly contribute to job creation. Federal agencies need to modernize information systems and records keeping to maximize accessibility, including creation of data in machine-readable formats, and safeguarding and maintaining internal and external data asset inventories as part of the order.
Is your agency looking to realize better efficiencies and cost savings through a proven information management program? Iron Mountain stores and protects billions of information assets, including paper records, backup tapes, electronic files, and medical data, helping federal agencies manage their entire information lifecycle. Learn more at ironmountain.com/radio.
And now, Technology Insights with Tom Frana, President and CEO of Vion, speaking with John Mansfield, Executive Vice President, Global Solution Strategy and Development for Hitachi.
Are there any surprises that you've seen over the last 18 months, 2 years, that will lead to something significantly different in the next 18 months or 2 years?
We're seeing a lot of movement now in solid state. We're seeing a lot of movement in data analytics, the adoption of the Web 2.0 architectures. I'd say if you look at where Hadoop came from, it was really the Web 2.0 guys trying to solve problems that traditional IT vendors did not. So that's going to be one of the things as you look at what does the open source movement do, how do you adopt it, how do you leverage it, and how do you implement these sort of technologies into your IT roadmaps going forward.
For over 33 years, Vion excels at providing IT solutions and services, addressing the most complex requirements. With partners like Hitachi Data Systems, Vion customers are offered the most innovative technologies available with Vion's level of reliability and flexibility. To hear more of Technology Insights, visit Vion.com.
Tom Temin here with a preview of Friday's Federal Drive. For federal workers, what you get paid depends to some degree on where you live, but at a Pennsylvania Army depot, two localities occupy the same spot. And it's that time of year when people are thinking about fun things, like maybe a new boat. We'll have advice for how Fed should evaluate loan offers for big-ticket items. Those stories and much more tomorrow morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. My guest on Industry Chatter today is Michael Markulek. He's the president and CTO at Lumetta. And we talked a little bit before we went on the air about the fact that your company does work in the private sector as well as the public sector. What's the breakdown right now?
It's about 50-50.
Okay, so you're spending as much time with private sector customers as you are with customers in the federal government.
Yeah, and when I talk about we'll talk about government because it's both domestic as well as some international. We deal with NATO and the Ministry of Defense in the UK.
So it mixes down even then within the public sector, your public sector business. There are some parts there too.
Correct.
But the thing that I'm curious about is another thing we chatted about before we went on the air is the
let's call it the unique syndrome that some federal agency people have, which is what they're doing is really different and special and unique. And yet it strikes me that there must be some lessons that federal agencies can learn from the private sector customers that you deal with, things that they're doing or things that they're not doing that maybe aren't being leveraged as well as they could in the federal government.
Yeah, you know, this insular nature, you know, that you seem to get in the government, is not always true, right? You know, the VA, and I'll talk about the VA for a little bit. The challenges the VA faces are the same challenges large, you know, hospitals and hospital, you know, organizations, right? I think about New Jersey. We have Capital Health that's got, you know, several hospitals, doctor's offices, right? So they face the same kind of IT challenges. They've got the same kind of, you know, oversight responsibility or oversight in terms of what they're doing. And they're delivering the same kinds of services using the same kinds of equipment, right? So I think the government, especially U.S. federal government, could take some lessons that come out of the private sector. We've seen the private sector really start to focus in, and we talked about it a little bit earlier, on defining, you know, critical assets, realizing that they can't protect everything. They also do a very good job of bringing new devices onto the network. I mentioned earlier physical security, right? You think about hospitals and, you know, you've got swipe cards and, you know, you've got secure rooms, right? You want to make sure if they're on your IT network that they're not going to cause any harm to the other systems on the network, right? I think the government approach has always been, you know, we're going to lock up everything like Fort Knox. Well, you know, that works for critical assets. That works where you need to do that. But when you do that, you also stifle innovation, right? You stifle people's ability to bring, you know, bring their own devices to work and make use of them. You also tend to stifle communications, right? We're going to segment things. And we're going to lock it down so hard, and we're going to have policies that say we're going to preserve every email you send for the next 100 years. And then people are reluctant to communicate in that fashion.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it really comes down to a set of policies and procedures in the government that maybe they can leverage what's going on in the commercial space.
The word that you used, innovation, comes up over and over and over again, and it seems like everybody has a different definition of what that means in the federal space right now. What is your sense of what real innovation is? Not necessarily a specific example, unless you have one you want to share, but and are you confident that federal agencies recognize it when they see it right now?
Innovation can be simple, right? And I'll give you a great example. I'm an ex-Army officer. You think about something like a supply sergeant in a warehouse or in a depot who wants to do his job better, right? So what he does is he goes out and he gets himself a wireless access point, right? He's innovating, right? He's making his organization more efficient,
mm-hmm.
right? He's moving in the right direction in terms of, you know, providing better services to his down-road clients. You know, in today's world, wireless access points are, you know, $100 and you're off and running. The problem is that innovation has created a security gap, right? So what you want to do is you don't want to necessarily stifle innovation. You don't want somebody to do this under the covers, right? You want to put policies in place. You want to put, you know, a leadership, you know, a structure in place that allows folks to come forward with these kinds of ideas, whether they be as simple as that supply sergeant, you know, in his depot, all the way up the chain to the federal CIO and you know, his, you know, work on mobility, right, or work on telecommuting, right? You want to have a structure that allows these kinds of innovative things to come into the government. Unfortunately, that's not where it's at today.
Yeah.
I see some examples where it's moving in that direction. As I mentioned, you know, some of the work on mobility, some of the work on telecommuting. Those are innovative kind of things, but they're still up at the top policy levels. They really haven't trickled down to the agencies yet.
And that's the part of it that seems to me is pretty dramatically different in the federal sector, at least, from the private sector, which is, to use your example, some guy that goes out at a company and says, well, wireless access would help me in this warehouse or whatever, and goes out and gets it, may at the very worst get a little chastisement for spending the $100. In government, that's a big problem because who knows whether that vendor is compliant with blah, 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 whatever the regulations are. So there are potential, I guess, legal and compliance issues there that aren't as easily resolved as they would be in another environment.
They're not as easily resolved. And I guess the point I was trying to make is that the policies that are in place, the leadership structure that's in place, doesn't allow that kind of innovation, right? It stifles that kind of innovation. Whereas in the commercial space, you know, if you talk to a bunch of, you know, you go to Merrill Lynch, now Bank of America, talk to a bunch of financial consultants. If they can find something to do their jobs better, to be more efficient, right, it's the CIO's and the chief security officer's responsibility to find a way for them to do that safely, right? You know, it's not, you know, in the government, the typical answer is no,
yep,
right? In the commercial sector, the typical answer is yes, but, right? And that yes, but, that yes, but it's got to be encrypted, or yes, but you're only going to have access to this information, is really what continues to drive the innovation on that side. And you see it with things like, you know, we talked about BYOD, right? My laptop sitting behind us in a bag, right? If I was to VPN into my network, I have only a certain slice of access, right? Because I'm on the road, right? Very different access than when I'm sitting inside my office, very different access than when I'm, overseas and coming, you know, trying to get in on a terminal sitting in an airport, right? Mm-hmm. So we can segment access, we can segment controls very tightly, right? The technology's out there to do so. I think the government's just kind of lagging behind in terms of how they've implemented that. And again, I think it's stifling that innovation.
A couple of CIOs that I talked to, both current and former, have used the term CINO, that's where they kind of felt they started and were trying to move away from that and get to a CIS position. And we'll talk about that a little bit more when we come back, about some thoughts that you have about how to make that happen when we continue. Michael Markulex, my guest. He's the President and Chief Technology Officer at Lumetta, and we'll continue industry chatter in a moment on Federal News Radio.
The Cybersecurity Report is brought to you by University of Maryland University College.
Earlier this year, information security firm Mandiant identified a previously unknown group of hackers thought to be in China.
People referred to China or Chinese hackers, but there was plenty of wiggle room to assume it could be a collection of guys working in somebody's basement without a tie to the government.
Richard Baitlick, chief of security for Mandiant, says the group is called Unit 61398, a part of the Chinese military. I'm J.J. Green.
Secure your future with a bachelor's or master's degree in cybersecurity, available entirely online from University of Maryland University College. Their programs have been specially developed by experts from government and private industry, so you'll get the real-world skills you need for your career. Plus, UMUC is designated as a National Center of Academic Excellence in Information Assurance Education by NSA and DHS. University of Maryland University College. Call 800-888-UMUC or visit umuc.edu/cybersecurity. Security.
Here's Susie Iacono, Deputy Assistant Director, NSF, on the Federal Executive Forum on Big Data, sponsored by HP.
And we can really begin to develop a science of learning because we have the complete data set on how people learn. And so I think that big data is going to change the face of our research in all of these areas, mm-hmm, and make a big impact on national priorities.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Data is coming at us at speeds we can't even measure. Everything we do depends on it, capturing data, transforming that data into information, then into actionable knowledge. The future belongs to those who can harness and use this data to analyze, improve, and better serve their workforce and constituents. HP is ready to help agencies convert information into actionable intelligence that drive faster and more informed decisions for government. Make it matter. Learn more at hp.com/go/big data.
Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, sponsored by AT&T, every Tuesday morning at 11 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. Federal Tech Talk has the latest on products that help bring policy to life. Check out the world of high technology in the federal government as John speaks to CISOs, CTOs, and CIOs and gets into the specifics for federal IT systems integrators. Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, sponsored by AT&T, Tuesday mornings at 11 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Eyeballing.com.
Eyeballing the Lawn. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss. With HHS HealthBeat, have you ever thought maybe the grass does not want to be cut? Consider that lawns can fight back with a sharp poke in the eye. Mowing the lawn with a power mower can kick up sticks and stones high enough and hard enough to do serious damage to an unprotected eye. Eye doctor Rachel Bishop of the National Institutes of Health notes that protection is easy to get and can make a big safety difference in yard work.
They sell these kinds of protective eyewear in eyeglass shops, in sports shops, in hardware stores. So this is easy to find, and the materials are light and comfortable.
Look for glasses marked ANSI Z78.1, which meet the American National Standards Institute's requirements. Bishop says they can stop a 90-mile-an-hour golf ball. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
The odds of becoming a signed artist and having 3 number one albums? 1 in 100 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of this performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 88. I'm Toni Braxton, and I encourage you to learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Now your Federal News Radio cybersecurity update, afternoons at 30 minutes past the hour. The Affordable Care Act creates some complicated electronic plumbing. Members of Congress are worried about the security of data flowing through it. But the head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services says the individual's health information will be safe. Marilyn Taverner says the digital hub connecting state marketplaces and federal databases transmits information but won't store it. When applicants seek health information at a marketplace, the information they submit is compared to IRS and Social Security information. Taverner tells a House panel the application process won't ask for personal health information. You get your cybersecurity update afternoons at 30 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com, and continuing our industry chatter conversation with Michael Markulek, President, Chief Technology Officer at Lumetta. And we talked about that transition from being the CINO to, you know, you're not going to do this, whatever it is, and transitioning to the CIS, in where you're able to tell folks, yeah, we can figure out a way to do that, to make that work to benefit the agency. And it as we chatted with a little bit about during the break, that's more, it seems to me, a risk management framework than an IT management framework. And so maybe it's a different set of skills than just expertise in IT management. Is that fair to say, do you think?
It is fair to say. And you know, I think we can, you know, the federal government and you know, to be quite frank, a lot of other commercial industries can take a lot from, you know, some of the things the financial service has done. And I've you know, looked at them, mentioned them a couple times. They've taken security operations and put it underneath of the CIO. Right, and the CIO's job is really to make the business run, to make it more efficient, right? To make things happen. So the fault for a CIO should be to say yes, right? You know, how can we do things better? How can we make our employees more efficient? How can we, you know, deliver the service that we're delivering if we're a federal agency? How can we deliver it better? How can we interact with other agencies in a more streamlined fashion, right? Those are the challenges that the CIO should be facing. The chief security officer, and I truly believe there is a need for a chief security officer, they really become audit and compliance, right? They become that chief risk officer that you see in the financial service world, and as you alluded to, they should be the ones who are monitoring this, saying, all right, I understand that we're trying to be more efficient, but you know, what level of data should we share? And it was interesting, you know, as you were winding up the break there, I was listening to the cybersecurity report. Mm-hmm. They talk about, you know, the Affordable Care Act and all the information that's being shared via the Affordable Care Act. It's already being shared, right? It's already being shared. Your records are already at hospitals, right? You're already interacting if you're involved with, you know, Medicare or Medicaid, right? The government's already got access to that information, right? So I think we at times look at this and say, you know, these are whole sets of new problems. They're not whole sets of new problems. We're already addressing these. again, if we can get the CIOs to be the man that says yes, yes to innovation, yes to efficiency, yes to delivering better service, and really have a strong security organization that's focused on risk, right? Not saying no, but evaluating risk and holding people responsible standards.
If we're well, there's a couple things I want to pull out of that. Do you see the same kinds of risk aversion in the commercial space that you see in the federal government space?
In certain areas, there is. You know, but they've contained it. I talked about manufacturing earlier, right? You know, they're building walls around their manufacturing networks to make sure that there is nothing connected to them, right? And there's a whole set of security-related solutions, both technology and service solutions, you know, to help organizations defend those networks. And that extends to power plants, and that extends to wastewater management, water treatment, things like that. So I think, you know, they do have a high level of risk, right? You don't want to be shutting down a nuclear power plant, right? Because somebody had access to a system that they shouldn't have access to. We do see it in certain industries. In other industries, you know, they accept a lower barrier of risk, right? Rental car agencies, right? You know, okay, they've got inventory, they've got fleets, they've got control systems to help manage that. They've got, you know, purchase requisition kind of systems. But if all of that crashed down one day, what's the real asset that company owns? Vehicles. And the vehicles are going to be there tomorrow, right? And maybe you lose a day's worth of revenue. Maybe you didn't rent the car. Maybe, you know, more likely, and this seems to happen to me quite a bit, you go there and the car that you've reserved is not there.
If the problems that we're looking at are not new problems, if they're just formed in a different way or set up differently, how does that change the way that we address them then? You mentioned the example of having of this personally identifiable information being available.
Yeah, so while the technology, the challenges we face are very similar, the threat vector has clearly changed, right? You know, the attacks that we see now, whether it be, you know, if you've read the Mandiant report or if you, you know, look at some of the information that comes out of Verizon or IBM, you know, the attacks have become more sophisticated. You know, you look at the average time from breach to detection. You know, in some cases, it's over a year, right? So these have become, you know, a much different kind of attack than we faced in the past. In the past, it was, you know, and South Korea recently had a problem, inadvertently got blamed on the Chinese. But it was really where somebody had come in and just, you know, infected laptops, infected some servers, and basically wiped them, right? All right, that's kind of the nuisance attack that we saw in the past. We saw our own financial services have the denial of service attacks, again, you know, in this case attributed to Iran. But again, those are nuisance kinds of attacks. We've seen a decline in the nuisance kind of attacks, right? And an increase in the more sophisticated attacks, right? Pulling in, you know, industrial information, right? Designs for, you know, stealth fighters. You know, accessing financial services and, you know, the, you know, credit card and credit card fraud that you see going on. So I think the attack vector has changed, which has compounded the same problems that we've always had. And, you know, you started the question, you know, do we have the same problems? Yes, we have the same problems. It's about, you know, determining what we need to secure and then putting a strategy in place to secure it. Right.
Yeah, let's talk about the transition of the attack vector when we come back. My guest is Michael Markulek. He's the President and Chief Technology Officer at Lumetta, and we'll continue our conversation in just a minute. This is Industry Chatter on In Depth with Francis Rose.
Systems, we realize it's critical that our armed forces can get the job done, even when budgets are tight. That's why our engineers created the technology to transform an unguided munition into a precision laser-guided rocket, the perfect low-cost surgical strike solution. Knowing our work makes a difference inspires us every day, so we'll be there on the next front. That's BAE Systems. That's inspired work. Learn more at BAESystems.com/nextfront.
Be a part of the USO of Metropolitan Washington's annual Stars and Stripes business-to-business networking event and fundraiser for the troops on October 4th at the Sheraton National Hotel in Arlington. Mingle with top corporate executives and celebrities. Nosh on great food and bid on amazing auction items. Join in as the USO Metro announces the 2013 Circle of Stars, honoring the top corporate donors for the year. Event sponsorships are still available. To learn more, visit WTOP.com, search charities.
Hamid Jafari eradicated polio in India. John McKinnon rescued 160 victims of child pornography. And Kevin Geis saved the Air Force $1 billion in energy costs. The list of federal employees making a real difference goes on and on. 31 individuals and teams of feds are being recognized for their work. Each has been named a Service to America Medal finalist. Hear interviews with each of the nominees and learn more about what makes them tick at federalnewsradio.com. Search Service to America.
Management Friday on Federal News Radio. Friday mornings at 10, listen for AFGE's Workforce Perspective on Inside Government. Next at 11, Shaw, Bransford, and Roth talk about the legal implications of management decisions on Fed Talk. And at noon, listen for Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch to hear what career options may be available. Management Friday on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
You're listening to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now your DoD report brought to you by BAE Systems, afternoons at 40 minutes past the hour. After failing an operational test, the Missile Defense Agency is conducting a full evaluation of the nation's ballistic missile defense capabilities. Navy Vice Admiral James Searing is director of the Missile Defense Agency. In testimony before the Senate Appropriations Defense Subcommittee, he says because the missile system failed its test, all future evaluations will be reviewed and will likely include a repeat test of the failed system. You get your DoD report brought to you by BAE Systems, afternoons at 40 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Michael Markulek is the President and Chief Technology Officer at Lumetta. He's my guest on Industry Chatter today, and we talked about the attack vector in the last part of our conversation, Michael. And as the threat vector changes and the scope of possible attacks changes, I wonder what your trends you're seeing in the ability to defend against them, because I'm thinking in particular about the Saudi Aramco case where they had a number of computers and pretty much a whole network that literally were melted down through a cyber attack, that the hardware pretty much had to be junked and the network rebuilt. And it seems to me we're going to look back in a couple of years and see that that was kind of the next generation, the beginning of the next generation of attacks. And when you think about that as the progression of that started out with, you know, a couple of kids in the basement and we're just going to be annoying, and you use the word nuisance attacks to talk about some of the examples that you gave in the last segment, how far and how fast do you expect to see this attack vector progress and evolve, and what level of preparation are you seeing in both the commercial world and the government world?
So the advancement of the threat, from, again, you talked about the script kiddies, I talked about the kind of a nuisance attacks, to really organized crime, and I think that's probably the biggest threat at this point. And when I use the term organized crime, right, this could be out of Russia, this could be out of China, but they're looking to extract, they're looking to extract information that leads to a financial gain for them. I'm hesitant to talk about, you know, cyber warfare, right? I tend to think of things in terms of cyber espionage, mm-hmm. right? Espionage has been going on forever, right? And you know, whether we're flying planes or whether we've got satellites up there that are mapping railroads, right? Because they're potential targets should there be an attack. It's no different than, you know, somebody mapping our power grid, you know, in case there was an attack in the future. Right? So, I tend to separate those two. And you think about state-sponsored kind of stuff. State-sponsored kind of stuff has been in that espionage. And, you know, that's, you know, I think that's where that's going to remain. What I'm seeing is that, you know, 85% of the critical infrastructure in this country is in private hands. We think about power generation. I talked about wastewater management. And there's been no clear legislation that's requiring them to reinforce these networks. So in a lot of cases, these networks are very antiquated. And, you know, being a resident of New Jersey, right, we suffered through Superstorm Sandy. And I was personally without power for you know, 14 days.
Oof.
You know, the power grid, the power company can't tell when you're without power. You have to call them, right? There's no intelligence built into that system. This is a system that was built in the, you know, the 20s and 30s in a lot of cases, right? And has really never been updated. So if we think about, you know, how fragile that system is to just a weather event, right? If there was really somebody who wanted to do harm, who wanted to bring down, you know, the power grid, you can imagine that it's obviously a difficult process to do, but not impossible. And I don't think that we're spending enough time or effort, both from a legislative perspective nor from a real boots-on-the-ground perspective, to protect the critical infrastructure of the country.
The critical infrastructure protection is something I've never heard anybody in the years that I've been covering this say, yeah, it's fine. Everybody agrees that there are vulnerabilities in critical infrastructure, and everybody agrees that some form of legislation would protect or would force critical infrastructure companies to protect themselves better and exchange information with the government more. And yet we don't seem to get anywhere on that. And we're back in the same boat again in this legislative year, where it doesn't appear that any cyber legislation is making any progress. What does, in your mind, as a cyber professional and not a politician and not a cyber or a critical infrastructure provider, what does effective legislation look like? What's included?
Well, I think we need to set some minimum thresholds. I think we need to set some reporting requirements, both in terms of when a breach has happened and you know, how breaches are reacted to. And, you know, I may get slapped on the wrist by some of my colleagues here in the D.C. area. We need something that looks like FISMA. We need a reporting structure that says how well you're doing against the standards that we've set, right? Right now, we don't have that. You know, I know NERC and FERC have some things that they have. I know that local organizations, you know, monitor this. But, you know, I'll take in my own backyard. We have what's called the Ewing-Lawrence Sewer Authority, right? I've met with them several times. They have no clue what's being attached to their network, right? And, you know, you think about wastewater management, you know, what does it mean, dumping sewage into the stream? Yeah, that's a problem, right? And I think we need to educate. I mentioned during one of the breaks, and, you know, I don't like to pick on politicians, you know, the leadership in Washington really needs to start to understand, you know, what the problems are. And I think we're getting there. But we still have, you know, congressmen and senators, you know, who are having their emails printed out for them, who are dictating emails, right, to their administrative assistants, so that they can, you know, that's how they communicate. How is somebody like that making decisions on, you know, how to protect cyber attacks against wastewater treatment facilities, right? So I think there's this gap in Washington right now. It's an education gap. And it's being closed, but unfortunately, at least from my point of view, it's not being closed quick enough.
Michael Markulek's my guest. He's the President Chief Technology Officer at Lumetta. He's here for Industry Chatter today, and we'll continue our conversation in just a minute on In Depth with Francis Rose. Be right back.
The Pentagon and Beyond is brought to you by EADS North America.
For the Marine Corps, the term Semper Fidelis is a way to distinguish itself from any other service. The Latin term means always faithful. It became their motto in 1883 and guides them to remain faithful to the mission at hand, to each other, to the Corps, and to the country, no matter what. The Marine Corps says there's no such thing as an ex-Marine. Once a Marine, always a Marine. If you have stories about the Marines or any other distinguished service member, drop me a line. at jgreen@wtop.com.
Meet Cameron Ballard, Marine Corps veteran and EADS North America employee building the Lakota helicopter for the U.S. Army.
The United States military really taught me a sense of pride, ownership. I brought that along with me here. I work on the Lakota. It's a great helicopter. Try to put a little bit of me in every helicopter. It's an American-built machine. We're putting it out to the United States military. I do take a great deal of pride in the fact that we're on time, on budget with every aircraft.
EADS North America. Commitment defines us.
Cyber solutions for 2013 and beyond. Stopping attacks and navigating a changing landscape. A discussion with leaders from industry and government. Sponsored by Merlin International. Now, Kelly Dempsey, Senior Information Security Specialist in the Information Technology Lab at NIST.
Baseline controls like least privilege and authentication requirements and make sure that people, insiders, don't have access to information they don't need access to. And I think in a lot of organizations that ends up, people get access creep and they end up with access to information that they don't really need to do their job. That's, like I said, almost going backwards because that's an idea, that's a concept that's been around for a long time, but it's an important one.
With today's dynamic cyber threats, your agency needs a security partner with solid expertise. Merlin International and industry partner NetApp are recognized leaders in cybersecurity, creating effective solutions deployed for the federal government. Learn more at merlin-intl.com. Merlin, secure performance.
What makes PowerJobs.com powerful? It's you. PowerJobs.com was created for you, the Washington area professional working in federal contracting, nonprofit and association industries, technology, and government relations. PowerJobs.com features thousands of top-level openings from hundreds of the region's leading employers. There's already been 2 million job searches on PowerJobs.com so far this year. Tap into the power of PowerJobs.com, a career site made for you. PowerJobs.com, empowering today's top talent.
Who says summer is slow in Washington? Break through the noise of end of fiscal year buying with GovEvents.com. The premier online resource for government and military events worldwide, GovEvents has over 25,000 members, providing a great platform to reach the government audience this busy season. GovEvents provides a cost-effective way to reach the government and military community with your brand, product, or event advertising. Contact them today at GovEvents.com to learn about available packages. GovEvents.com, where government gathers.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Michael Markulek is the President, Chief Technology Officer at Lumetta. And we just have a few minutes left together. I appreciate you being here today. I've enjoyed this conversation. What should be on the radar screen of IT professionals and IT security professionals in government right now that maybe isn't or isn't as prominent as it should be, in your opinion, Michael?
So I'll really talk about two things. One goes all the way back to the beginning of our conversation. The need for continuous monitoring, right? Networks are dynamic. They're changing. They're changing every day. I've written and talked about how I think the cyber world is as big, if not bigger, than the real world, right? There's more kids that are playing right now on the cyber world, you know, games, than there are out in the streets playing. Probably because it's 110 degrees here.
It might have something to do with it today.
But it's a bigger world. More transactions occur, financial transactions occur online than do in banks, people handing in checks, right? So the constant change and the growth of the cyber, you need a continuous monitoring system, right? The other thing that I'm seeing, and it's really become an industry trend in the security world, is that you can no longer have different pillars, different solutions for different, components of your network, right? We're always going to need a firewall. We're always going to need to defend the perimeter. But if your firewall is not talking to your intrusion detection system, if that's not talking to your advanced persistent threat solution, if you don't have a holistic view of how you're protecting your perimeter and those systems don't talk and report in the same language, then you've got a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So I see a trend. You see it through some consolidation in the industry. You see it through standards groups where organizations are meeting so that they can share information. And you see the end users demanding this. No longer, is Lumetta's solution going to sit next to an N-Circle solution, sit next to an ArcSight solution. If the three of them don't talk, right, you're not going to be successful.
Mm-hmm. The trend line in this business, what do you think it looks like for the business side, for companies over the next, say, 2 to 5 years?
You know, there's still tremendous growth, right? Even in some things that are, you know, considered brownfield, you know, kind of commoditized. You know, I mentioned Qualys, right? That whole host vulnerability management space. There's still growth there, right? There's still organizations that are deploying it across more of the network. And as we add new and better things to our network, laptops, Xboxes, right? Whatever's on your network, your physical security, we're going to need to provide antivirus for that. We're going to need to provide vulnerability management for that. We're going to have to be able to protect it. So I think there's still a tremendous growth curve in the security industry in general. I certainly see it in the, you know, advanced persistent threat arena, the continuous monitoring arena, and really this consolidation so that, you know, instead of having 16 panes of glass that you're looking at to make a security decision, it really needs to get shrunk to one, right? And then we need to automate as much of that as we can. Take the human error out of this, right? When I log into my network, boom, you know, a vulnerability check should be done in my system. Make sure that no viruses or anything's been added to it. Make sure that my encryption on my data is still secure and allow me access to the files that I'm allowed access to. And that's all going to happen in a nanosecond.
Yeah, and that's actually where I was going to go next, is how much of this can we expect to see automated and how far down that path are we, do you think?
Well, it's interesting. At Lumetta, we've been involved with the Trusted Computing Group for years. It's an open source standards-based organization. Really focused on bringing, you know, industry partners together to share data. And early on, it was a lot of theoretical talk. Now we're actually seeing it deployed. We're seeing, you know, in the case where we're very active, we're seeing network access control systems being deployed that utilize all the available information about the network and about the endpoint to make sure that you can make the best decision. Versus a single vendor proprietary solution, now you can run it across an entire, you know, suite of products. That's the kind of trend line that I'm seeing. That's the kind of trend line I think, you know, our clients are demanding. And I'm working with my partners in the industry to bring that about.
I got a big stack of stuff here that I'd like to go over with you, and I'm out of time. But I really appreciate you coming in, Mike. It's great to see you here.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. Michael Markulek is the President Chief Technology Officer at Lumetta, and my conversation with him on Industry Chatter today will be archived later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Hour number two of In-Depth with Francis Rose is next on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. We'll be right back.